It is Monday, August the 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, an attack in Venezuela, plus when will they be rewriting the Constitution?
No one knows what anyone wants to be in the new Constitution, but primarily they're simply taking control.
China calling on North Korea to adhere to UN resolutions and begin a dialogue.
The call from the Chinese for dialogue is one that most nations are putting emphasis on.
Also ahead, social media news and Philadelphia's Walk of Fame. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says soldiers battled for 3 hours on Sunday against a small band of anti-government fighters who sneaked onto a Venezuelan army base, apparently intent on fomenting an uprising. VOA's Victor Beatty sought some insight from Jennifer McCoy. She's the former director of the Carter Center's Americas program, currently a political science scholar at Georgia State University.
I'm not surprised that there is or would be some dissent within the military. There have already been perhaps up to 100 military personnel expressing their dissent from the government and detained at some point or another. And with the situation as it is, it's quite volatile in the country, and with a new body that is considered by many to be illegitimate, this constituent assembly that was elected on Sunday, there will certainly be opposition to that, not only from the political opposition who has rejected it, but I would imagine from within the security forces as well.
Is it fair to say that the lower ranks of the military may be more sympathetic to the anti-government movement as opposed to the senior officers?
I think some of the dissent that we've seen has definitely been coming from the lower ranks. They are not as privileged in terms of receiving the benefits. And, you know, many of them, I think, are facing some of the same pressures as the civilian population in terms of low salaries and difficulty in finding medicines that they need, et cetera. The upper ranks, of course, have been promoted along the way over the last 15 years to be loyal to the government and the governing party. And the military has also been rewarded with a number of businesses, control over food distribution and other nationalized businesses. As well, of course, there have been allegations, particularly from the United States, of military personnel as well as government personnel, high level, being involved in drug trafficking and other forms of illicit activity.
This new constituent assembly, controversial as it is, apparently one of its first acts was to vote to remove Chief Prosecutor Luisa Ortega Diaz. How significant is that?
It's very significant in that this represents a dramatic constitutional clash in that two bodies had come out opposed to the executive branch. The legislature that was elected at the end of 2015 and heavily dominated by the opposition, of course, had been in the political opposition. This prosecutor, Luis Ortega Diaz, had been a loyal government representative and member of the governing party until April of this year when she denounced the Supreme Court's efforts to intervene in that opposition legislature. So she's been a critic in terms of denouncing unconstitutional moves and actions by the Supreme Court and by the executive. Therefore, it was not a surprise that she was removed today by this new body, which is very loyal to the president himself, to President Maduro. But the constitutional clash is what we're seeing and is going to be played out and is part of the extreme fluidity of the situation right now.
Well, what will this new assembly now do? We're told they're going to rewrite the Constitution. You suggested last time that perhaps the Constitution, the document's already been formulated, and they'll just quickly vote on it.
I don't know if they have a draft or not. I think that the purpose of electing this was, one, to distract from the situation, the very difficult economic and social situation, and two, to avoid regularly scheduled elections, which have already been some of them postponed from last year, some of them supposed to be occurring in the next months and then next year the presidency. This body may or may not focus quickly on a new constitution. No one knows what anyone wants to be in the new constitution, but primarily they're simply taking control and particularly asserting control above the existing legislature.
What does the opposition do now? What is its strategy going forward?
I think they have already taken one step forward today in terms of a show of unity with a group that is called referred to as dissident Chavistas. So there have been three legislators from the governing party who have defected from and formed their own bloc. And then there are some other former leaders, as well as this prosecuting attorney general. And they have come together today in a forum in Venezuela. And I think that the strategy that they will most likely follow and that could be the most effective would be to for that political opposition to reach out further to these dissident Chavistas who want to protect the existing constitution and democratic principles and to form a larger united front. That will probably give them more leverage, both in the eyes of the international community as well as against the government.
Jennifer McCoy, a political science professor at Georgia State University. She's former director of the Carter Center's Americas program, and she was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. A global pressure campaign on North Korea propelled by new UN sanctions received a welcome boost Sunday from China, the North's economic lifeline, as Beijing called on its neighbor to halt its missile and nuclear test and engage in dialogue with concerned nations. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, meeting with North Korea's top diplomat during an ASEAN ministerial meeting in Manila, urged the North to maintain calm, in his words, despite the UN vote. We asked Stephen Norper, Senior Director for Policy for the Korea Society and a professor at Columbia University, if this is encouraging news.
Encouraging signs in the sense that these are the toughest sanctions that have been applied. Speculation is that they may hit as much as one-third of North Korean exports, or over $1 billion. So they're designed to close loopholes and have real impact. Of course, the call from the Chinese for dialogue is one that most nations are putting emphasis on, and the United States is through the message of Secretary of State Tillerson, who also has said that dialogue is much needed. And the Japanese are a bit resistant and want to see sanctions have impact first, but it seems to be the consensus that we need to get to the negotiating table sooner than not, given North Korea's dramatic increases in terms of missile and nuclear enhancements.
And also, what about the U.S. reluctance so far to engage in dialogue with North Korea?
Well, there has been hesitation because the precondition was a commitment to denuclearization. But I think that the pragmatic concerns are such that the advances warrant talk sooner than not. And there have been many proposals across the U.S. public sphere and in scholarly and analytical circles that a freeze is needed or some sort of moratorium, and that's only achieved through negotiation.
And we also asked the Korea scholar if he was surprised by the unanimity of the vote in the UN for more sanctions on Pyongyang.
No, the signals were that the vote would take place, and that wouldn't take place unless China and Russia were in line. So there had been some agreement that had been struck, although it took a month between U.S. and Chinese negotiators to get us to the point where there was movement and common accord.
And we also asked Norper what else he thinks China's Wang Yi discussed with North Korea's top diplomat, Ri Yong-ho.
It appears that the Chinese are conveying that they delivered a firm message to North Korea. At the same time, they tried to put that in a toned-down manner. They said they spoke to the North Koreans about not having too strong a reaction to these sanctions put in place, to take it in a measured way, and they urged restraint. At the same time, Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, also reiterated that there needs to be some trade-off in terms of U.S. and South Korean exercises, in essence, a freeze for freeze, and called for the United States and South Korea and others to come to the negotiating table with North Korea.
That is Stephen Orper, Senior Director for Policy for the Korea Society. He's also a professor at Columbia University.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Well, it turns out that the U.S. economy posting some good numbers as indicators seem to show faster forward expansion. Stock markets continue to set new records reflecting positive news of the economy's future. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman tells my colleague Jim Stevenson that amid all these trends, Republicans and the White House remain mired in political wrangling that could undermine what seems to be improving without their help.
Jim, here we are in the eighth year of an economic expansion, and the latest indicators are that it may be accelerating somewhat. There was GDP growth numbers at an annual rate of about 2.6%, the most recent number to come out. And that was uptick from about the 2% and even a little bit less than that that we had seen earlier in the year. The unemployment numbers came in very strong. New job creation, more than 200,000 new jobs created, and the unemployment rate went down from 4.4% to 4.3%. And the question is, if this continues and we get towards real full employment, where just about anybody who wants a job can get a job, does that mean that we finally, after all these years, begin to see wages rise? That has been a big conundrum, where we've had years of economic expansion at a very slow pace, but the American people really haven't felt it in their pocketbooks. Maybe now they will begin to, if in fact this trend continues.
These are some of the issues that Donald Trump was talking about on the campaign trail. It doesn't necessarily have to do with Donald Trump, because he hasn't been in office that long, and really none of his policies have been enacted so far, as Congress continues to grapple with some of the more contentious issues like health care. But overall, the economy has been building steam for a variety of reasons.
Jim, Donald Trump was very quick to take credit for it on his Twitter feed, as he is prone to do, and to say, you see, what I am bringing to Washington is working. And it is sort of an unwritten rule in Washington that whoever is in power either gets the credit or the blame for the economic performance, whether they deserve it or not. Here's the argument that Republicans would make, that as soon as it became clear last year that Republicans would have control of Washington and that a low-tax, low-regulation regime would be coming into power, that boosted confidence and that businesses started responding. They started making plans for expansion, and we are now seeing the fruits of that. Democrats would point out that, in fact, this is an economic expansion that began long before Donald Trump came into power. There are any number of ways to look at it. However, in general, if a president is in office when the economy is expanding and people are feeling pretty good, that does tend to boost the popularity of a president. And when you look at the poll numbers, that is one thing Donald Trump could really use. His poll numbers have been sinking. I think that the White House would very much love to see some bump in his approval ratings.
You mentioned businesses had made plans based on this great outlook of what may come. Republicans now have to follow through with something substantive to keep that momentum going.
Well, that's the cloud on the horizon for Republicans. They failed utterly in terms of repealing and replacing Obamacare. Now the next thing that they're going to look at is tax reform. In addition to that, there is the debt ceiling, which we're bumping up against. Congress has to act on that as soon as they come back from vacation in September. We still don't have a budget plan for the next year that's been approved. There's a lot on Congress's plate, and you're right. Here's the danger for Republicans. If they fail to deliver on these promises, upon which they themselves are arguing that this increased expansion is based on in terms of the economy, well, what happens if those hopes and expectations are dashed and the outlook grows more pessimistic? Well, guess what? We have midterm elections coming up next year, and if things start to look gloomy and the economy recedes from this expansion, that would be deep trouble for the Republicans indeed.
Never failing to make good on his promises, the promise of telling us what's going on each and every week, VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman.
Always a pleasure.
Indeed, a pleasure here too, gentlemen. Time now to find out what's trending on social media. My colleague Lori London here. What you got, Lori?
Well, Steve, as one headline I recently came across asks, is social media the new tobacco? A bunch of new studies are finding it's not just becoming addictive, but that addiction is stressing people out. A recent study by a researcher at the University of California looked at the links between the use of Facebook and well-being and found that the more you use Facebook over time, the more likely you are to experience negative physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction. And teenagers, especially these days, unlike generations in the past, are growing up with smartphones and apparently dedicating a very large part of their time to apps like Snapchat and Instagram. And researchers say the more they do, the less they interact with the world, with other people, with friends, go on dates, rather than just talking via these apps. That research is backed up by a professor at San Diego State University by the name of Gene Twenge, who reports in The Atlantic this week that smartphones are causing teens to go out on less dates, to go out less in general, and really just feel more depressed. She says as they constantly search for approval, comparing themselves to others on these sites, the worse they feel. Along these same lines, her study also found that teens today not just going out less with friends, they're less interested in learning to drive, and the rates of depression and suicide have risen dramatically since 2011. And she also attributes the problem of social media with FOMO. FOMO, or fear of missing out on the fun everyone else seems to be having. Now, a study from Connecticut Children's Medical Center that looks at anxiety levels in 18 to 22-year-olds is also finding similar results, that the more time spent per day on social media, the more anxiety symptoms. And while it's hard to break the smartphone social media addiction, a team of researchers in Denmark divided up a group of Facebook users, had one group take a break for a week from the site, and found that that may be all that's needed to improve mood. The people in the study who took a break had a noticeable improvement in their positive attitudes and feelings and life satisfaction. And interestingly, the heavier the Facebook users who took the break had the highest boost in happiness, according to the study. So overall, it seems clear from these studies that stepping away from social media has only positive effects. No one seems to become more depressed from taking a break. But beyond all this, the news isn't all bad when it comes to social media. There's also growing evidence that it has a unique ability to raise awareness about important issues and causes and also expose injustices that would otherwise potentially stay in the shadows. And a perfect example is that there's an entrepreneur that's just created a movement called the Santa Claus Effect. It's working to have social media users focus less on themselves and more on content that has to do with helping others and bringing about social awareness. So I guess it's really true with social media, as with any other so-called addictive substance, so to speak. Everything in moderation.
Oh, I get it. So I just should be moderately addicted to it. I can handle that. Thanks, Lori. VOA's Lori London. You can follow her on Twitter at Lori London. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found right there on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
New findings from Ellen Boss, a scientist from the Carnegie Institution for Science, seems to back a long-held theory that the process that formed our solar system was set off by a shockwave from a supernova. A recent analysis of ancient meteorite samples shows an excess of the isotope nickel-60, which scientists say is formed from the decay of iron-60, a radioactive, short-lived isotope. This isotope, they say, is only created in large amounts by nuclear reactions inside certain kinds of stars, including supernovae. Boss tied the analysis with his computational model of a shockwave-generated cloud collapse and into the intermediate stages of the sun's formation. He says his findings suggest that a supernova shockwave is the most plausible origin story for explaining the existence of iron-60 isotopes in our solar system. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Says VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Time now for our report from the music department, and today some musical honors about to be bestowed.
Your hair, I'm pleased, I really dig your company. Your style, your smile, your peace mentality. Lord, have mercy on me, I was blind, now I can see. What a game supposed to be. Baby, I'll be free. Come on and go. Let's take a long walk around the park after dark. Find a spot for us to spark conversation. Global elation, simulation. Shit.
The U.S. City of Philadelphia's Music Alliance will induct a lineup of influential musicians spanning a wide range of genres to its Walk of Fame. They include Philadelphia native Jill Scott, who first hit the music scene in the year 2000. She's known as a singer, songwriter, poet, and actress, and also known for such hits as A Long Walk. The 2017 inductees to Philadelphia's Walk of Fame features a star-studded list of musicians and artists, from guitar virtuoso Sister Rosetta Tharpe, sound of Philadelphia acts like McFadden and Whitehead, and the Soul Survivors, plus the 1970s R&B group Sister Sledge. Sledge is a vocal group hardly without equal. Formed in 1971, the group consisted of sisters Debbie, Joni, Kim, and Kathy Sledge.
We fly just like birds of a feather. I won't tell no lie. All of the people around us, they say, can they be that close? Just let me state for the record, we're giving love.
Philadelphian Patti LaBelle is being inducted alongside Sarah Dash and Nona Hendrix as part of the 1970s group LaBelle. Patti LaBelle is a superstar entertainer with lots of hits, and was once heard to say, "I just sing the stuff that makes me smile, makes me feel like I didn't sell myself out." Well, likely her biggest hit is "On My Own," sung with another Bravo entertainer, Michael McDonald. Philadelphia Music Alliance board member said of LaBelle, Sister Sledge, Jill Scott, and so many more that their honorees show why Philadelphia remains a hub for award-winning talent. Philadelphia's Walk of Fame has honored more than 130 Philadelphia musicians since its inception in 1986. One of many great songs by Patti LaBelle and lots of others around her. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you so long. Hey, I'd like to thank a couple of people. Indeed, as we do every Sunday, Tracy Carter, an engineer, Greg Burns, Tracy's our directors. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. It's still Sunday here. I know it's Monday everywhere else. But hey, listen, have a super Monday. Let's listen to some more of Patti LaBelle and Michael McDonald.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian Supreme Court recently upheld a ban against the Jehovah's Witnesses after the Russian Justice Ministry labeled the Jehovah's Witnesses an extremist group in April. It is the latest in a disturbing trend of persecution of religious minorities in Russia that includes the Church of Scientology. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert urged Russian authorities to lift the ban on Jehovah's Witnesses activities in Russia, to reverse the closing of the Jehovah's Witnesses Administrative Center, and to release any members of religious minorities that continue to be unjustly detained for so-called extremist activities. We further urge Russia to respect the right of all to exercise the freedom of thought, conscience, religion, or belief, said Ms. Nauert. The Jehovah's Witnesses was organized in the 1880s in the United States. There are more than 8.3 million Jehovah's Witnesses worldwide, including about 175,000 in Russia. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, a federal committee responsible for making policy recommendations on international religious freedom to the President and Congress, also denounced the ban. The Supreme Court's decision sadly reflects the government's continued equating of peaceful religious freedom practice to extremism. The witnesses are not an extremist group and should be able to practice their faith openly and freely and without government repression, said Daniel Mark, chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
This commission has designated Russia as a country of particular concern for systematic, ongoing, and egregious violations of religious freedom. All religious minorities in Russia should be able to enjoy freedom of religion and assembly without interference, as guaranteed by the Russian Constitution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.